Welcome to this episode of the Ghost Stories podcast, and I hope you've arrived here ready to learn, because that is what is going to be happening, whether you're listening to this in your car, on a jog. It's going to have to be a fairly long jog, because I think there's going to be a lot to talk about in this excellent show, but I'm really excited to do it, because we've got some serious heavy hitters here. So Reginald Labuschagne, or Reg, as he's allowed us to call him for the sake of this podcast, is currently sitting in Swellendam, which is pretty interesting. That's when you get to the cool part of your career. You get to go and speak to clients in a place like Swellendam rather than a place like, we won't mention, places with potholes and all those sort of tough places. And Reg is the head of product and strategy at Sanlam Private Wealth. He brings over 20 years of experience in the financial industry to this discussion. Reg, you've done everything from investment products through to turnarounds of distressed businesses. You've got a lot of knowledge of the regulatory environment. So let me just start by welcoming you. Thank you for joining as part of your busy trip to Swellendam. It is work and not just play down there. So thank you for making time for us.
Yeah, guys, thanks for having me on the podcast. It's a privilege to be here and look forward to the discussion. And I think welcome to all your listeners as well. Hopefully you can learn something out of this. So.
I think we're going to learn a lot. And of course, joining us all the way from London, we have Harris Gore. Now, he's a partner at Grove Point Investment Management. That's a specialist investment firm in London. It has invested in private markets since 2006, and those of you who were working in 2006 will know that it was a bull market. That was a fun time. I only finished studying after the financial crisis, so I've never known this bull market of which people speak. But anyway, Grove Point knew about it a bit, at least. And before that, Harris, you were at Investec for 16 years before you joined Grove Point in various roles, including asset management, investment banking in London. So, you know, there's a hell of a lot of experience here, and I guess you must be quite sick and tired by now of telling people that you are with Grove Point and not Growth Point, at which point they ask you for your views on the latest shopping center developments.
Ah, yes. Thanks, Ghost. Great to be on the show with yourself and Reg. And yes, Growth Point certainly isn't a household name. That's mostly, I'd say, by design, though. We've traditionally worked with a small group of large institutions. Our network, probably over the last 20 years has really expanded via word of mouth. And in fact, it was one of our network that obviously introduced us to yourself and to Reg and the investment team at Sanlam, who have been very helpful and supportive of what we do.
Absolutely. And if those people are listening to the show who made the introductions, thank you very much. It's always nice to be connected to interesting people. That's for sure. So I think, Reg, we're going to start with you, because I think private markets really have taken off in popularity in the last couple of years. I mean, just from my perspective, at least, there does seem to have been a bit of a structural shift, actually, in favor of private market opportunities. It feels like there are fewer and fewer new opportunities coming to public markets. I mean, we recently had the listing of We Buy Cars here on the JSE to much fanfare, which is, at the end of the day, an unbundling of something that you could actually already buy through transaction capital. It's not like, you know, the big old IPOs of those bull market days that I've only read about in the classics, really. So the point here is that, you know, you've got to kind of get a bit more creative, I think, when you're looking for new opportunities for portfolios. And I guess the first question here needs to be, when you're thinking about portfolio strategies for your clients and the allocations that you want to make, to what extent are private markets featuring for you these days, as opposed to just looking at what is publicly available?
Yeah, I think it's a critical question. And I think especially in our space, because I mean, we deal primarily with private clients, right? So just to be clear on what that means is we deal with individuals who have, you know, their own needs, and they each have their own portfolio with us. So we build a portfolio to a client's specific needs. And I think why that's important in this discussion, we don't run a big pooled vehicle where it's easy to just go, we want 10% of our total big fund or, you know, pool that we want into private markets. We've got to sit with each client, understand their requirements. You know, if you go into private markets, there's quite a bit of hurdles you've got to get across, from illiquidity to large ticket sizes to get into it. So it's much as private markets are interesting, which I'll get into now why, when you deal with private clients, it's not that easy. So the structural shift you've spoken about, yes, there's been a massive shift globally with the listed space. There's less and less listed companies. We know most of the companies in the world are private, and so there's huge opportunities in that space. And what you've seen in the institutional market is there's been a massive shift to a lot of the public market stuff going into passive, as we know, and then people look for alpha or things that beat the index in the private market space. So the access to private markets has definitely increased with access to technology, access to information, all of that stuff. So it's becoming more interesting and easier for certain institutions and people to invest in private markets. And there's more and more of these large private market players that are looking for ways to access the retail market, because it normally starts in the institutional space and then things start shifting across into the, call it the retail, or what you want to call man on the street. I guess there's different ways of defining that, to give those people access. And that's, you know, the space we play is almost that bridge between institution and retail, because our private clients typically have larger portfolios and they are looking for interesting things. So, you know, we're constantly looking at how to access these markets. But as I say, the biggest challenges, which we'll probably get into part of today's discussion, is the access to that. So we know it has a very important role to play in portfolios, because if you find good private market operators, you can really extract some good returns for clients. But therein lies the biggest challenges. Firstly, finding the right players in the market. Secondly, how to invest in those things operationally and make it accessible to our type of investors. And hopefully that's part of the guts we'll get into today. So I'll leave it there for some further questioning.
Yeah, I mean, so just to be clear for the listeners, you know, when we talk about private assets, we're not talking about mom and pop shop companies that you can go and acquire because you want to go and buy a business, or even those sort of private equity opportunities, 200, 300 million rand companies. You know, that is not something, Sanlam Private Wealth is not going to go and structure that transaction and then, you know, dish that out to five clients in their private portfolios. That's not the sort of private market stuff that you guys would actually consider. So maybe before we carry on, what are some examples of the private assets that actually do end up in portfolios where it does work from a liquidity perspective? And you've raised the liquidity point, and I'm sure that is something we will dig into a lot in this podcast, but it helps people understand, you know, what sort of private market assets do you guys actually look at as that universe of assets? And then Harris, obviously, you know, we'll be talking about something a bit more specific today that you are very involved in.
Yeah, look, again, we've been trying to be quite innovative without trying to be fancy, right? What I mean by that is, the first thing, everything we invest in for clients it's got to play an important role in a portfolio. So we've got to understand the fundamentals of what we invest in, what the role is in a portfolio. So does it add better returns? Does it diversify the risk? Does it, you know, so there's different roles that an instrument can play in a portfolio. But to answer your question on what we've invested in, so we have invested directly in private companies. So even the example you said about a 200 million rand opportunity, we have done one or two of those for clients.
Turned out to be a terrible example. It's always fun when you assume something and it's completely wrong. I love that. I've already learned something today.
That's part of the debate, right? I mean, that's how you learn. So
exactly.
We won't necessarily invest in the valuation of a business that's at 200, but we have allocated about 200 million rand across a couple of client accounts into private businesses. So we've done that. I won't name the names. I don't know if we should or shouldn't, but we've done, you know, one I can name is Dis-Chem. So we were in Dis-Chem quite early before it listed. So we had some private exposure for clients into Dis-Chem. And then, you know, that was something that worked out very well, because, you know, when we went to listing, we had a big value tick up. We recently invested in a privately in an insurance business, but more and more, the more sort of, I think the more sensible way, because it's heavy lifting every time doing a big due diligence on every business you invest in, is to actually go, we've got a big multi-manager team that do quite a bit of work in the institutional space, looking for private equity managers, private credit managers, you know, even hedge funds and some other exotic assets. And so they do a lot of the due diligence work. And then we sit with them and basically look at those opportunities and see which of those opportunities are good opportunities for our clients to invest in. And then we got to figure out the operational stuff from there. So we've invested in South Africa in one or two mid-market growth private equity fund managers. That's worked out very well for our clients. I mean, the one fund we're in now, we probably about in the exit phase now, a lot of the investments. So if you think about private equity, there's an initial pot of capital that a private equity fund manager will raise, and then they deploy that capital over 3-4 years, depending on the investment cycle. And then it's pretty much a 10-year lock-in, again, depending on the fund structure. And then eventually the managers have to exit at the end to get your return and your capital back to investors. Now, we're pretty much on that final stage, and that's where you really see whether the manager's good or bad, when they can start exiting businesses and give capital back. And we've probably done about a 28% net IRR for our clients on that. So good rate of return on an annualized basis. And then we've invested in a couple of private credit funds locally and offshore. And that's where, you know, more recently we've been in long discussions with the team at Grove Point around their solution and understanding that in more detail. And we've you know, in the last, it's probably the last couple of weeks, we've gone through a proper investment committee process and approved that for investment as well. But again, we need to understand what role that plays in a portfolio and how to construct that as a portion of a client's overall portfolio. I hope that answers the question.
No, it does. It's great. And I think obviously for, you know, most listeners will already be aware, but risk return is ultimately the trade-off in finance, right? So when you talk about 28% returns in private equity, that's good. That's well done, actually. But, you know, private equity needs to give you those kind of high 20s, ideally, to actually, you know, make up for the risk involved. So this is the beauty of portfolio construction, right? Is you're looking for different risks at different levels with returns that are commensurate for the risk you're taking. And then all the diversification that comes out as well, you know, and then you've got a good outcome for clients. And I think before we jump across to you, Harris, to learn about this stuff, which I'm really excited about, what must make a difference here, Reg, is just this proliferation of listed instruments that go and reference private market assets. You know, that's got to help a little bit with the liquidity problem and some of the due diligence issues as well, which you've raised there, which is why I'd assume there wasn't much activity in big private equity. But I guess when it's deals like Dis-Chem pre-listing, I can understand that. When it gets too small, it's just too hard. So that's where listed instruments that reference these sort of underlying opportunities become very helpful for you as an allocator and portfolio builder.
It does. Look, even if it's listed, your due diligence work is still the heavy lifting part. So you gotta, you have to understand the team, you have to understand their strategy, because in, as you know, and take private equity as an example, you can, firstly, private equity is a very broad thing from very early stage high risk to later stage buyouts. So there's a big spread in private equity strategies. Then in each one of those categories, there's different ways that people apply themselves. And what, you know, some people will take, you know, minority stakes and have a passive view on a business. Some will take significant minorities all the way to majority stakes and take control of the businesses, change management. So you've got to really understand each one of those managers and what role they play and what value they add into businesses or how they extract value in the investments they make. So your big challenge in private equity, I mean, I quoted one good example, it's always dangerous, but you know, the spread in returns in private equity is very big. So you can invest in the same sector and the same strategy, and one manager will do potentially negative and another manager will do 30% per annum, right? And that's your risk, is the, as you said, the risk return payoff is significant. So even in the listed space, you've got to be very careful about the managers you pick. So you still need that due diligence and understanding of the underlying. The only part the listing really helps is to give clients access into to be able to trade out, because I mean, liquidity is a massive thing for clients. You know, when, and you only realize it when you need capital and you need to exit, and then you realize there's no market, and then you take big discounts on anyone that's willing to pay for that asset. And even in the listed space, you'll see that, and you can go trace the prices of these things. At some points, they trade at significant discounts to the underlying assets. We've seen some, I mean, you can quote numbers of 30, 40, 50% discounts on some of these counters. And in other times, they trade closer to their NAV. So you just got to be aware what's going on in that market as well. So as much as it's convenient, there's also risk in buying those things for clients. And you've got to be very aware of what you go into.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess where the listed instruments help as well is just getting access to other markets. You know, it's one thing to do private deals in your home market. It's another thing entirely to be able to find opportunities offshore and be able to bring those into a portfolio. So Harris, I guess that's ultimately where GrovePoint is such a cool example, and something very interesting is it actually gives people the ability to invest in private market stuff somewhere else in the world, preferably somewhere with electricity, although we seem to have that as well in South Africa. You know, we'll see after the election how much electricity we actually have. We won't get into that now. What we do know is that there's a big world out there. And I think for anyone actually thinking about long-term wealth creation, it's the old eggs in one basket situation. I mean, I've been to many a presentation in my life by wealth managers about how small South Africa is in the global context. And by the time you take into account the property you own and your job and everything else, you're probably too exposed to SA, almost guaranteed. So of course, it's really cool for me. I just think it's really cool when there's opportunities on the local market to be able to get exposure to stuff elsewhere in the world. And that obviously is where you come in on this podcast. And I'm excited to learn about this space from you.
Certainly, Ghost. I suppose building on what Reg said earlier, the market has really trended in these two directions. So you have one being your passive investing, cheap, low-cost access to listed equity and often listed credit via ETFs. And today, if you look across most client portfolios, they have at least some exposure to low-cost strategies. Some of them, all of it is really exposure to low-cost strategies, and with an asset allocator making the call between equities and debt and which asset classes to kind of skew to. But number two is the search, and we've really seen this, as Rick said, drift from the institutional space more into the wholesale private client space, is the search for alpha via private markets. And it kind of makes sense that alpha can be generated in these markets because there's asymmetric information, people with deep sector expertise, like sponsors that have deep sector expertise in specific industries can use that expertise and knowledge to generate excess returns. As bigger sponsors, so bigger pools of capital can generally use that scale to their advantage. There is a shortage of capital in private markets when you consider the size of the private markets compared to the size of the AUM in them. There's still a lot of room for growth. And then there's issues around complexity and access to that information. So there's real reasons why good managers can generate alpha. But as Reg said, it's very much about which horse you back and your access to that horse, your information in that space, how you select the right managers, the right underlyings, and how you deploy your capital. But going back to, I suppose, the two trends, once again, anyone listening will have exposure to the S&P 500. Very few will have exposure to US private companies. And we'll touch on, hopefully a little later, how big that market is. But what we're talking about today, which is really kind of senior secured loans to these high quality private companies. These loans are earning 10 to 12% in a portfolio. This is a very attractive diversifier, especially when those returns have been fairly robust and consistent through market cycles.
Yeah, I mean, there must have been quite a lot that attracted you to this space, right? I mean, it's quite a big career decision to kind of go from public markets into doing the more private stuff. And it's really interesting. There's a whole lot of different opportunities within private. You've got to go and really scratch to find the right stuff. It's a little bit harder in that regard, I think, than some of the public market stuff, which is available on a screen. You know, private markets is not available on a screen in terms of the underlying assets. You've got to actually go and find those opportunities to go and deploy capital, you know, depending on what the model is of the fund. Maybe it deploys into other funds that hold these assets. But ultimately, this money is landing in a private company that is raising some form of capital. It's either debt or it's equity, depending on, you know, the mandate of the fund. And there's so much you've got to balance here. You've got to balance the quality of the assets, the depth of disclosure available, the level of the management teams in those companies. People forget that there are private companies that are as big and impressive as public companies and run to the same standards or better. You know, people say private companies, we assume it's the fish and chip shop down the road. Yes, that is a private company, but there are some massive, massive private companies that dwarf mid-caps on the local market.
Yeah, Ghost, without a doubt, the depth of the market is just incredible. And I mean, one of the stats that it's worth noting here is that in the US, 90% of companies generating more than $100 million of revenue are private. So that market, these are private companies, so middle market companies, that market taken in, say, isolation, so just on its own, would be a $10 trillion a year market in GDP terms. So you're talking about a market here that is three times greater than the UK economy. It's bigger than India, Japan, or Germany. Yet it's a market that very few investors have any exposure to. So these private companies, they're generating earnings of up to $1 billion a year. There are almost 200,000 of them. They employ the majority of the US workforce. I mean, historically, I suppose lending to these companies was highly prized business for the US banks. But this all changed in 2008 when banks were badly wounded by the global financial crisis and lending dried up around the world, especially in the US, which was the eye of the storm. And then you had this deluge of regulation that sought to limit how many corporate illiquid loans US banks could hold on balance sheet. And in fact, it sought to limit how many illiquid anything, any assets that banks could hold on balance sheet. And as a result, you had an exodus of the bankers who did that business. So the expertise and the intellectual property that sat within these banks that had the relationships, did the origination, and did these loans to these high quality corporates in the US, those bankers moved and often to establish private equity managers, now alternative asset managers and setting up private credit funds. or setting up their own private credit funds, or going into insurers and doing direct lending. And this pace of change was without a doubt greatest in the US. When you look at the numbers, there was a 50% fall in the number of US banks between 2008 and 2022. To give you a sense of how that compares to, say, the UK. In the UK, there's been less than a 5% fall in the number of banks over that same period. In fact, there's been an increase in the UK in challenger banks, as many people in South Africa will know, after some homegrown talent bought a bank not so long ago in the UK market. So there's been a kind of growth in challenger banks and a very small decline in the number of banks in the last 14 years. And it's really worth pausing on that, because it's this dramatic decrease in US banks combined with the regulations that made it more expensive to lend to these kind of high quality private companies, that's what created this opportunity for private credit. In fact, the opening left by the banks after 2008 was so large that, as you mentioned earlier, many of these private credit managers, Apollo, Ares, Oaktree, Blue Owl, New Mountain, Blackstone, the list kind of goes on. The top private credit managers listed vehicles on the New York Stock Exchange and the NASDAQ to take advantage of the opportunity to lend to these private companies, to these middle market companies. So these were managers that already had their private credit funds, established these illiquid lockup funds, but they added AUM via listing separate listed vehicles on the New York Stock Exchange and the NASDAQ. And these vehicles raised more capital from a different set of investors. So it gave the managers access to new capital from public market investors that could then support their kind of growing lending franchise. So this is what many investors don't know, is that today there are over 130 listed private credit vehicles in the US. Many of these vehicles are larger than, say, the SA financial institutions, and with shares that are certainly more liquid. So if you think about a well-constructed portfolio today of listed private credit vehicles in the United States, could trade $700 million a day. That's almost half the liquidity on the JSE. Speaking to Reg's point earlier about liquidity, this means you can invest 500 million rand or a billion rand in this market in a day and not move the price. And that's very, very attractive. I mean, that's significantly more attractive than developed market bond markets, which where everyone will probably know liquidity is really drying up. So kind of more liquid than your public credit markets. And 40% of US private credit can be accessed via these listed markets. So that's really the interesting place that we are in today when you're looking at private credit markets.
Now, you touched on the strategy you guys run, and I want to come back to that. But the one question I did have, just listening to that journey, sort of from the global financial crisis, then into the, what is it now, like 16 years thereafter, basically. I mean, it's amazing how a crisis breeds opportunity, right? It's the most horrible cliche in the book, but it is very true. And obviously, what I'm guessing or wondering is, you know, now that yields are higher, interest rates are higher, some of the banks will start competing in this space, I guess. They'll come back in, right? They'll say, well, actually, at this sort of lending rate, we can maybe compete, or is the cost of compliance just so heavy for them that you almost need to still be this lean, mean fighting machine that was built in a low yield environment and can now compete in this one?
Yeah, Gus, that's an interesting question. The banks have never gone away entirely. You're always going to have banks competing to lend to high quality middle market companies, especially as say loans get larger and when the broadly syndicated loan markets are working well. Often billion-dollar plus loans will be divvied up and sold on to asset managers. And so the banks don't need to hold these loans on balance sheet. These syndicated loans generally have standardized terms, and they're often where kind of cov-lite loans will sit. And that's due to the nature of the business, which is to syndicate fairly standardized documentation. The direct lenders, the private credit managers, really tend to focus on loans below this threshold. So they can move much faster than the banks, and they can offer more flexibility and, say, price certainty to the borrower. And in exchange for this, the borrowers need to pay a higher credit margin. They need to agree to customized loan documentation. Because the documentation is now customized, you can incorporate greater monitoring rights, security over the underlying assets or cash flows of the business, better financial covenants, and really just greater control. You've got a direct relationship with the borrower, so you've got a greater control and better lender rights in the event that that borrower defaults. Now, it's really hard to see how banks re-enter that market when the relationships, origination, structuring skills, they've all relocated. And this trend has been going on for almost 20 years now, where the number of banks has decreased, as we touched on earlier, and the number of direct lenders and the amount of kind of firepower they have or lending capability they have has got larger. So being quite blunt about it, top lenders, so top individuals at these banks, why would you stay at that bank? You've got more flexibility to originate business, and you're going to get paid more at a private credit manager than they could ever do at a listed bank. So it's really hard to see how this trend reverses now that the relationships and skills have moved out of the US banks, and that's been going on for so long. And once again, that transfer of market share and skills from banks to non-bank lenders, it's really been unique to the US. I think in South Africa, banks are still kind of your first stop if you're running a business generating 2 billion rand of EBITDA, of earnings a year. Similarly, in the UK and Europe, you've got lots of regional banks and lots of smaller banks that still dominate the middle market. In the US, that middle market belongs to non-bank lenders. And frankly, the business fits better in a direct lender or a private credit fund. If you're going to hold illiquid loans on your balance sheet and you're going to fund those with short-term deposits like banks often do, then you're really asking for trouble. It doesn't matter how big your bank is. If you're holding too many illiquid assets and deposits start running out of the door, you've got a big problem, which is why US regulators, again, are trying to tighten these bank capital rules. But if you raise permanent capital like these direct lenders or you list these permanent capital vehicles on the New York Stock Exchange and the NASDAQ, then you can recycle that capital whilst paying out obviously the distributions from the loans as dividends, and you have no short-term depositors funding your capital. So it's really a much, much better place for these loans to sit. And that's from both a regulator's point of view and probably from an investor's point of view.
Yeah, those asset liability mismatches are, of course, a serious risk. And Reg, I want to bring you back into the discussion here to just give us some South African context to this, because I think Harris has really given such a good lay of the land of what's going on in the US. And I can completely understand that there's just so many, you know, big enough companies that it actually creates this alternative debt market. I mean, do we really have something like that in South Africa, or do the banks pretty much address all the high quality assets and the rest of it is pretty much working capital loans into SMEs and not a hell of a lot else?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think it's changing. Look, I think the first difference, as you said, it's the depth of the market, right? So the size of the market and the quality of the underlying businesses, the growth in the economy that's fueling businesses' growth. You know, so that's where South Africa is very different. You know, we've got some good stories in South Africa with some private businesses doing well. And again, in South Africa, you've got more private businesses than listed businesses doing significantly well. I mean, you just have to drive around some of the industrial areas and look at some of the brands out there. So what you are seeing, there's more and more private credit fund. We've invested in one or two private local private credit fund managers, and they've done extremely well for our clients. I mean, the one fund manager is running, you know, they've got a long track record, probably 11 years now, and they've been doing probably on average in rand terms about between 16 and 19% per annum because their floating rate on their loans as well, so it goes up and down with interest rates. But it is extremely hard work for the guys in South Africa to find proper deal flow. I mean, if you speak to these managers and you look at their pipeline of potential deals, that because everyone's looking for funding in South Africa, right? So there's definitely a big funding gap in South Africa, but to find the good quality businesses that you can really, you know, as Harris said, most of these guys will want to securitize. If you put let's say R1 million, for argument's sake, loan or R10 million loan into a business, you want security of at least, maybe these guys will want 2x security, right? So there must be assets probably worth 20 million as an example for that R10 million loan, because you need to have control of that business when things go wrong. You need to be able to dictate the terms and you know, basically be able to securitize that loan and get your money back in some way. And, you know, so that's where you really start seeing the good managers versus the bad managers and how they structure those loans. And so to answer your question simply, it's definitely growing in South Africa, but there is still a lot of the working capital funding, factoring, you know, all of that stuff that, that's taking place. So there's a big market in that space, but you're definitely seeing more and more private lending starting to take place. Some of it directly from family offices into businesses where they've built teams, but you are seeing an increase in funds that is participating in that space. But to be clear on it, it's no different to the private equity model. You've got to go do a proper due diligence on the underlying managers, understand their process. I mean, the guys we invested in, if you understand the work they do, as much as the returns look good, and they haven't had, I mean, I think their worst return on any investment they made or loan they made to a private business was basically getting their capital back after a big court battle. But if you understand that rolling up your sleeves and getting involved in the underlying businesses, they are, you know, they can probably run, I don't know, 8 to 10 big lends at a time, because they have to be, you know, every month, every quarter, you know, manage the cash flow, see what's going on in that business. Because a lot of private businesses go through cycles, right? So you run into problems at some point, and then you've got to get the equity holders, you've got to get the debt holders, you've got to get the, you know, all the management teams on the, around the table and start discussing, you know, are the equity holders going to stump up more capital? Do you have to start selling something to you know, service your debt? How do you actually manage the situation? And I think where banks are failing, and again, I don't want to generalize here, but banks are very systematic. If you don't pay, we come in after your assets, right? They don't go and restructure. They're not flexible in how they manage the situation with the underlying loans. They don't have the teams, as Harris said. They don't have the skill set necessarily or the time or effort to go spend on those things. So they're very compliance-driven, very systematically driven. And that's really where you see the call it the secret sauce. I was nervous to say that because it sounds sexy, but it's actually just bloody hard work in the background to actually go make those things work and actually get squeeze out those returns over time. And I think that's where you really see the difference. And I think, again, back to the South African banks, it's easier for them to go do these big infrastructure loans into big projects where, you know, there's some type of contractual income stream, because again, matching that asset liability, you know, they've got short dated liabilities where they have to meet deposit holders withdrawing money from time to time. And if they go into these long dated assets, you know, they've got to make sure there's an income stream off that to service these short term liabilities. So they prefer these long term secure contractual things that's, you know, underwritten and they're big deals. They'd rather, you know, spend time on a couple of billion rand deal than they would on a 100 million rand deal. They're not going to spend the time and effort on it. And then it's, as I said, quite systematic in their approach. And I think that's where the sweet spot lies with these private debt guys.
Yeah, I mean, I'm lucky enough in my career to have had a bit of exposure to banking because I didn't do articles in the traditional way. So it was very cool to see how balance sheet management really drives everything the bank is doing. There's kind of this, you know, holistic view that says, well, this is what we can afford to do in terms of the assets we're willing to actually bring onto the balance sheet based on what our funding looks like. And therefore, you know, that team over there, you're getting a lot of capital this year to go off and do renewables or infrastructure or whatever, you know, go and make hay while the sun literally is shining and the electricity is not. And if you're stuck in the team that goes and does lending to private companies, you might not get such a big allocation of balance sheet that year. And that absolutely creates the opportunity for other players to come in and dart around you and make it happen. And it also just, these structural things happen as well because of how hard it is to scale the business. You know, you've talked about the amount of involvement that the lender, or if it's private equity, the investor or mezzanine funds or whatever it is, needs to have in structuring these deals, understanding the legals, engaging with management. I mean, it can get pretty hairy in that stuff for both sides of that deal, frankly, for the management teams as well, without a doubt. And you can't scale that into a big bank being able to do lots of formula-based lending, because that's what it is at the end of the day, right? It's credit scores and, you know, apply here and someone kind of just roughly makes sure that the form has been filled out correctly. Does it meet the score? Okay, great. You know, here's your money. There's no discussion of how to taper those cash flows or whatever the case may be. Just one example from the listed space as well of how even big companies can't always get the debt they want. New York Timbers recently announced a loan that they got from what looks like a bank in Holland, from what I could see, certainly not a South African bank. And I think that's because of how they had to taper the cash flows to allow for their harvesting of the trees and when their forestry cycle comes in. And, you know, I can't say for sure that there wasn't a local bank that knew how to do that, but I'm pretty sure they didn't go to a European bank because that debt was available at their friendly local Santon office. So it kind of shows sometimes you have to get quite creative about actually raising this capital. And that explains why some of these private market lenders have a business, right? And that's why we're talking about this today.
Yeah. And I think the simplest analogy, if you think about people that have been around long enough, and I think it depends on your audience, but in the old days, you know, you used to walk into your bank manager as a business owner in a small town, like I'm sitting in Swellendam now, the farmers would walk to their local manager, have a discussion, and that guy would have the authority to do a deal with that farmer. And they, it was based on a trusted relationship. Now that whole model just around that thing has changed fundamentally, where that decision-making at that branch was taken away to mitigate the risk of people doing irresponsible things. And because of the compliance systems, that's driving the whole kind of risk matrix of that bank. So that whole model has been drawn back to the center, and everything, all those decisions are made at the center now. And that has opened up opportunities for the people that will build those relationships with that farmer to go, let me come and understand your business, and I will come and fill that gap that's happened. And that's kind of a, I think maybe a simple analogy of how that model has changed and what's created this opportunity in a way.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, for you, Harris, trying to find the, you know, opportunities to deploy capital, that's the challenge, right? Is you are trying to effectively scale into an area of the world that is quite hard to scale into, or in terms of a type of investment. So I think let's spend a few minutes on the process you guys follow. You know, how do you actually go about allocating the capital? I mean, this is the process that Sunlime's basically just done a due diligence on and they were happy with. So it must be pretty cool. And I'm quite keen to hear more about how it actually works.
Thanks, Chris. I think as we discussed earlier, the size of the US market really combined with the kind of dominance, the proliferation of non-bank lenders means the job is a lot easier there because you've got this deep kind of liquid market. So when you think about how to invest in that market, this idea of scaling into the market, getting efficiently allocated, it's worth approaching it from a different angle, which is how kind of we've grown up in that market, which is, do you want to access that private credit market via your illiquid private credit funds, or is it better to look at this listed market? And that's where I think there are probably five points that are really worth considering for investors in this space. And that is that, how are you going to earn that illiquidity premium? So the US market is unique in that it offers this deep, broad, kind of liquid universe of listed vehicles that are managed by the same managers as the illiquid funds. And this allows an investor to now capture an illiquidity premium via listed shares. So for most investors, retaining that liquidity, that's a clear win. Number two really feeds on from that idea of liquidity, which is that you can manage your exposure better as an investor. So the deep market liquidity means you can be fully invested when you see opportunity, so dislocation in the market or attractive market moves. And then whereas in a private credit fund, you obviously have to wait for several years for your capital to be drawn. So there's no ability to efficiently invest in that in that respect. And then because of that liquidity, investors can also rotate their exposure. So liquidity is obviously very important for asset allocators like Sunlum and for a client base like this, because you want to be able to change and rebalance your portfolios in line with your in-house views, in line with macroeconomic views, and really in line with changing client requirements. And the underlying client obviously being very important. And then number three, really attached once again to this fact that you can access many loans via the listed market or many underlying private credit vehicles via the listed market, is that you can create a very well diversified portfolio, both across high quality managers and underlying borrowers. So generally, if you went into a private credit fund, kind of a top tier illiquid private credit fund, you'd need a $5 to $10 million kind of minimum investment to become a limited partner in the fund. And that would give you access to one single fund, so a top US private credit fund. That would then originate less than, say, 100 loans over the next 3 to 5 years. So draw your money over the next 3 to 5 years and originate, say, 100 loans. And this really means that only the largest kind of institutional investors can create a well-diversified portfolio in that space. You need $100, $200, $300 million plus invested to start creating a robust kind of portfolio and underlying borrowers. By comparison, your listed market, you can create a portfolio of 3,000, 4,000 underlying borrowers, and these are great companies. I mean, we're talking companies with average EBITDA over $100 million, so over kind of 2 billion rand of earnings each year. And these companies often have very substantial market share in their sectors. They've got wide competitive moats. And when investing in credit, diversification is really valuable because your upside is limited by your yield or your coupon. And so you want to kind of mitigate your downside as much as possible via diversification. And so you want to invest in kind of the broadest range of kind of high quality companies in great sectors. And what I mean by that is kind of avoiding cyclical industries and places like energy, hospitality, aviation, retail. You don't want that kind of cyclicality in your portfolio. And you can get that best via the listed market, really, in our view. And then you need to also, and this is quite a technical point, but it's worth delving into because you just need to have the correct systems in place if you want to get the best results in this market. So, and that's mostly because of a regulatory change that was introduced in 2015 by then President Obama. And that permanently changed the withholding tax treatment for non-US investors into the space. So for those unfamiliar with US withholding tax, pre-2015, if you invested in one of these listed private credit vehicles and they paid a 10% distribution, so a 10% yield, you'd lose 3% of that. So 30% of it would go to Uncle Sam via withholding tax. So post-2015, you can now reclaim most of that tax back. So historically, this would have cost investors up to, say, 3% a year of their return investing in these vehicles. And that's very material because when we look back to 2015, the markets generated kind of 10-12% returns. If you lost 3% of that, it's a material chunk of your return that's gone. But as an investor, you obviously need the right systems in place to monitor this, calculate, and claim for this rebate. So if you're an investor with a few hundred million dollars invested in these listed private credit vehicles, obviously doing a tax return costs you a few thousand dollars to get your taxes back with Uncle Sam is more than worthwhile. And finally, and this applies to many investors, but especially in this kind of hybrid private public space, you need to do your research. You need to have a process in place and you need to remain disciplined because experienced investors in this market and guys who know the market, have the right investment and tax recovery process in place, you can really generate very, very attractive returns. Better net returns, in fact, in this listed market than say the larger institutional investors are generating when they invest in the illiquid private credit funds. So you can kind of retain your liquidity and generate a better net return. And why is that? It's mostly because many of the public market investors have only, say, a rudimentary understanding of the underlying private companies and the loans in these vehicles. And so they tend to buy these shares for their high distributions. And then whenever there's a slight panic in the equity market, they sell the shares and therefore they're regular mispriced opportunities in the market and opportunities both to buy shares below their intrinsic value and to sell these shares when the market is, say, overpaying for the yield that they generate. So when we put this all together and we think about, say, asset allocation, this liquid access to private credit means you can really put portfolios together similar to kind of your large institutional or endowment style portfolios where, because you can create such a well diversified liquid kind of portfolio of private credit vehicles, you can allocate as much as, say, 15% of a client's portfolio, to the strategy.
So, Harris, we'll have to get you back to maybe talk through process. You've been threatening me with a good time of another podcast with you. So I think I'm going to have to take it up with you because clearly there's a lot to talk about, which will be great.
Please, Chris, I feel like I've said a lot already, but I'll gladly do round two with you guys. But actually, frankly, I would suggest anyone interested who's listening should really speak to Reg and the team at Sanlam Private Wealth. They've gone through this several times over the past year or so and know both us and the process very, very well.
Rich has a queue of people outside that window behind him waiting to come and speak to the manager who's got the debt. You know, they heard about him coming to Swellendam and all the farmers are waiting outside there through the window. So he's going to be a busy man soon.
I was saying, wait, they would be in here already. So
yeah, exactly.
No, but I must just say that the process is definitely worth spending time on and that's kind of where we, you know, the switch kind of went on in our heads about what they do is spending time, because it, you know, just buying listed private credit stuff, you can go do that yourself tomorrow, right? But it's having the discipline and the process to consistently apply something that will deliver returns over time. And that's what we've appreciated what the team do. So I'm going to highly recommend spending some time on that at some point in the future, just to understand what they do. And again, I think for us, as I said earlier, we need to spend a lot of time understanding every instrument we invest in and the teams behind it and how it works. And yeah, so that's kind of, you know, for us to tick the box on that was quite a step in the, it'll hopefully, I don't know, lend some credit to the whole process. But yeah,
absolutely.
It's worth spending time on.
Yeah, it's that scaling the unscalable concept that I really wanted to get to on the show, which is that these are inherently unscalable assets, but actually they also aren't. If you find a way to do this at scale into difficult stuff, you've got a cool offering. And Reg, you mentioned the instrument there. I mean, in this case, it's the Grove Point Investment Management Liquid Private Credit. So that's GIMLPC on the Joburg Stock Exchange. And I think, Harris, some of those net returns that you've highlighted there are in relation to, you know, the track record in that instrument. Of course, the one other thing we need to touch on, and when you say net returns, I'm assuming that means net of fees, but perhaps worth just spending a minute on, you know, how the fees actually work in this case. How aligned are investors with the manager of this instrument? You know, people are always obviously very sensitive to that.
Yeah, because fees are obviously very important, especially when investing in private markets and alternative asset managers. And I think managers in that space, you have to be aligned with investor outcomes. And so a material portion of the fee has to be linked to performance. As an investor, you want the best net return for a given level of risk. And so linking a material portion of the manager's compensation to performance makes total sense. And historically, this has played out very well for investors. They've taken 90% of the return generated since 2015. Once you've recovered taxes, their net returns add to 11 to 12%. That's per annum net in dollars. And that's based on this performance fees, and total fees would have been added to 1.4% per annum. So we think that that's a fair ratio. And although fees are important, as Reg mentioned earlier, it's more than just paying people to say select the right vehicles. You really want a manager here that's going to have a kind of detailed discipline process. They need to make sure you're not overpaying for vehicles. They need to crystallize gains when, say, the market's overpaying. And they need to have the right admin and technical processes and scale in place to really reclaim taxes and monitor and calculate those and monitor notices, et cetera. And obviously have that deep history, that insight into the underlying market and into the underlying universe of managers and assets. And if you're doing all of that stuff right, it's not complicated stuff. It's just there's sometimes a lot of it. If you're doing it right and you're doing it consistently, the returns are very, very attractive and they add great diversification.
So as we bring this to a close, I just want to give some context to that performance. So I just pulled up Berkshire Hathaway over 10 years on ticker, which tells me a compound annual growth rate of 12.7%. So I think in the 11s on debt, it's not to be sneezed at when Berkshire's managing a 12.7% CAGR over 10 years. So well done. I think that sends a bit of a message.
Hopefully we'll still be speaking to you when we're 99.
Yes. No, absolutely. So some longevity there that you still need to demonstrate, but I'll give you the last 10 years. That's for sure.
I think if listeners can see the 10 years now and you see the smile on Harris's face after that comment, would really be worth seeing it.
Yeah. I mean, listen, double digits in dollars is the real thing. That's a serious return. So well done, especially over that kind of time period. But anyway, I think just closing, Reg, from your side, I mean, you guys have kind of been through the process now with Grove Point. I mean, you've gotten yourselves comfortable around this thing. I guess the last thing I just wanted to touch on is, you know, we've now mentioned this Grove Point vehicle is listed right here on the JSE. I mean, we kind of touched on some of the liquidity stuff earlier, but I think maybe we can just end off there with, you know, what sort of role did that really play for you in terms of the comfort around this instrument, just in terms of access to it, the liquidity? I mean, we did talk about it, but I just want to really end there, because that's of course what makes this quite different to, you know, just going and trying to do this yourself in the private market.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think but for us, it again comes to portfolio construction. So there'll be a portion of a portfolio where we're looking for yield, especially dollar yield over time. And something that is not necessarily correlated with other parts of the portfolio for a client, right? So it means it doesn't move up and down in the same direction as maybe some other parts of the assets. So that part of your portfolio diversification. So there definitely plays an important role, but maybe just something I want to clarify on the access part, right? Because a lot of people say it's listed, so it's going to, like I said earlier, trade up and down with NAVs and discounts. That's not what happens in the way this instrument is set up. You can always see it as a listed fund. So what happens when we subscribe for our clients into this vehicle, it creates, effectively call it new units, probably the best way of describing it, and that then invests in the underlying assets. So it's because we had concerns from our portfolio managers. This is a very small listed instrument on the JSE, so the liquidity is going to be a problem. That's not the case. The underlying investments are very liquid, trading in a big market in the US, and they are, I mean, Harris can maybe final comment on the liquidity on the underlyings, but when you sell, you're basically selling units, you sell the underlyings, or there's already cash in the portfolio, that just redeems to the investor and you cancel units at the prevailing NAV that it trades at. So it's not this illiquid thing that's now, because just because it's listed doesn't mean there's always liquidity, but I think because of the way this is set up, you buy into a very big liquid pool in the background. I think it's just important getting that distinction out there as well. And then look, at a later stage, I think we need to spend some time probably on asset allocation with non-correlation, all those things, but that's a debate for another day, how these assets work in a portfolio. But I think that distinction is quite important just as a parting shot from my side.
Yeah, I think, Harris, when we get you back, we might have to see if Reg is in a cool small town again to join us on one of these. We can do it as a tour of the small towns. I think, gentlemen, that is pretty much we're out of time. I think it's been an awesome podcast. Thank you so much. I've learned a lot. I think our listeners have learned a hell of a lot. And, you know, to the listeners, all I can really tell you is do your research in this space. Just open your eyes to everything that's out there. It can never hurt to learn about a new thing. It really can't. You know, connect with the guys on LinkedIn, chat to people, reach out and go and have a look. As I said, the Grove Point Investment Management Liquid Private Credit ticker is GIMLPC. So if you can remember the full name, you'll just remember the acronym quite easily. Harris, Reg, thank you so much for your time today. It's been such a cool show. Enjoy the rest of your time in Swinnendam, Reg, and Harris, we will chat again. Thank you.
Perfect. Thanks, guys.
Thanks so much, guys.
Chat soon.
As always, you must do your own research and speak to your financial advisor before investing in any financial products. Sanlam Private Wealth is a licensed financial services provider, FSP 37473.